This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our very interesting program today was entitled Illinois Financial Twister. A tax hurricane may be coming for Chicago, the suburbs, and all of the state of Illinois. We have three panelists: Larry Massal of the Civic Federation of Chicago, Tina Safandola, Sun-Times reporter, and Juan Perez, reporter for the Chicago Tribune. All three agreed whoever becomes governor January and takes office in January of 2019 will face the same problems that the present governor, Bruce Rauner, and predecessors have faced in the state of Illinois. There simply isn't enough money to go around. Underfunded pensions, no money for schools, police, and fire, these are issues that have been building for years. The question that all three addressed: who will vote to raise taxes in an election year? Very few options, the panelists will point out. Raise more taxes, change the Constitution, and educate the voters of the state of Illinois, who they concluded don't seem to want to be educated on these particular issues. The good news: for the first time, a budget was passed on time this past legislative term, and there was bipartisan support. But the budget really did not address property taxes, huge billions of dollars in unfunded pension liabilities, and local government needs. And in 2020, in the city of Chicago, there will become a tremendous need for increased property taxes to meet pension obligations that have been agreed to. 7,000 local units of government are dependent on a tax increase, but who will lead the charge? The governor, the legislature, local governments, and the electorate, the population in general, to bring about the necessary funding. This is a question yet to be resolved.
Tina, you want to start us off? Thank you.
So I'm also a Loyola University graduate. So I'm a Loyola people. So I did a lot of studying on the state's pension crisis just when I first started covering politics several years ago. And as we all know, it just kind of, it is a good way to describe it as a financial twister, because we know that there's no real end in sight and it keeps on building and building. And the way to solve the state's pension crisis is not easy. If you ask anyone, no one really knows the answer. And I would compare that to the newspaper industry, of which I belong to. And if you ask the newspaper owner how to save newspapers, no one knows. We know it's expensive and we know that we want it to work, but we don't know really what the steps are. And I actually brought this up to our CEO, the Sun-Times CEO, and he had a good perspective on it. He did say, well, there are good people out there who do want to make good changes. And this is coming from a former alderman. So, you know, from the political aspect, I think there are some politicians out there who really know that we are in dire need of finding a fix to this problem. Lawrence is always the one to call me after a budget's passed and telling me, after like the kumbayas and the love fest and everything that I'm writing about, that everything's terrible, and providing it with like exact facts and figures about why. So I'm glad that you're here to provide all the facts and figures that we need. But the numbers are really scary. I think for this fiscal year, we owe $7 billion for the state's pension contribution. And as you know, last year we brought in $5 billion from the income tax. So do the math there, and there's a little bit of a gap. And the state's set to pay $8.5 billion to the five retirement systems next year. So about 10 years ago, we only paid $2.8 billion. So we are paying a giant chunk for our pension systems. And if you want to make this a partisan thing, you can point fingers at all different ways, but it's not just a partisan issue. It's been building on both sides. And a common thread is just that people are not regularly investing in the pensions and instead kind of putting it elsewhere. And in election years, it's very easy to do that, to try to avoid raising taxes or avoid other ways to make that money. So what will happen? We know that we're in trouble. We know that if it is not solved, there'll be more taxes. There could be more credit downgrades, which we've been watching avidly, and it's pretty scary, or even bond defaults. So the options, more taxes are maybe an option, trying to change the Illinois Constitution, which people think can't happen, but maybe it can. Maybe voting out judges that don't want to make these pension changes, or trying to get voters to understand the system, because I think a lot of people don't know what's going on. So I think it's part of our jobs, I think, as reporters to kind of tell people what's going on. It might be a mix of all those things. And I do think that in an election year, it's pretty tough to make any sort of super substantial changes. Thank you.
Okay. Juan, do you want to jump in here, and then we'll ask Lawrence to take over? Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to thank the City Club, of course, and my fellow panelists, and obviously all of you who came and are trying to stay awake through as I mumble and stutter into this microphone. So thank you for that. We're going to hear a lot of talk about numbers today, and let me just start with a couple basics. A year ago today, the Chicago Board of Education and J.P. Morgan closed a deal for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of short-term credit that the school district needed to settle its debts to the Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. This was a costly maneuver. A former colleague of mine and I concluded that interest costs alone were costing the district $70,000 a day, just in interest, until the loan was paid off. A year ago today, faced with the very real prospect of running out of money, the Chicago Board of Education took on a $500 million loan. The interest costs associated with that expense are upwards of $850 million over the life of the loan. $850 million on a $500 loan in interest. Don't worry, though. We'll pick up the tab because future generations are going to be the ones who are going to be stuck with the bill. Let's fast forward to today. I can't even believe the fact that we are just a few days from the end of the school district's 2018 fiscal year. And a lot of things have changed. Your school principals are seeing their budgets earlier than they have in recent memory. There's a lot of talk of stability at the Chicago Public Schools Central Office. And even the bond ratings agencies, if you can believe it, have even suggested that they may slightly upgrade what are pretty junk-level views of the district's debt. That's the good news. The thing is, if you ask somebody in the know, have these deeply embedded structural problems disappeared? Are we suddenly flush with cash? Have we finally found a way out of the dark? The general consensus is no, we haven't. So we shouldn't, at least in my view, we shouldn't forget these questions that we were just posing to ourselves not that long ago about whether or not the school district's finances are able to absorb or withstand in any way any kind of even mild economic downturn. Matt Phillips, writing for the New York Times this week, noted that the so-called yield curve, which has been a pretty accurate reminder of a predictor of recessions, recently reached levels that have last been recorded in 2007. Former Tribune reporter Heather Gillers, now writing for the Wall Street Journal, noted that Americans who are entering retirement are in far worse financial shape than their predecessors were. The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis concluded that millennials have fewer total assets, have higher levels of debt, and what am I forgetting here? Oh, yeah, lower net worth than the Gen Xers that preceded them. I say all this stuff just because it seems like these sorts of characteristics, that prognosis and these general conditions ought to kind of inform how we think about distressed governments in Kentucky, New Jersey, and yes, Illinois as well. Remember, pension funds rely heavily on investment performance to survive, and less aggressive investment return assumptions have already tacked an extra $1 billion to the Chicago Teacher Pension Fund long-term deficit. So, yes, it's true. The district can access more property tax dollars. There is access to more state revenues to pay off the overall expenses. But these costs are going to keep growing. And, I mean, we'll come back to this chart in a little bit. But this is just an example of what some analysts have put together showing that the ramp is increasing for all of the pension funds, just not CTPF. And even though that state contribution is helping out the school district, these costs are going to continue and continue to rise and pressuring the future generations that we were talking about a second ago. Cutting expenses can only get us so far, and we've obviously seen the legal and political peril that can plague even our most audacious attempts to cut expenses to trim fat or what a lot of people might describe as muscle and bone, vital organs. So there aren't really many places to turn for additional revenue. And whatever money it is that we are able to scrape together is certainly going to face stiff competition from other actors, from other parties, from other pension funds. And there's going to be a lot of competing demands for those dollars. We can deal with the rest in questions, but.
Okay, thanks, Juan. Lawrence, are we ready to give us some facts and figures and a few charts and so on?
Yes, indeed.
Great.
Thank you, Professor Mazur. Want to apologize for Tina and Juan not giving them top billing. Most people run when we start talking about the pension situation, but it was my oversight to not put your names up there for the record. And also, I appreciate you acknowledging that a hurricane or a twister is a good analogy. Got a little pushback from some people that said hurricanes don't happen in Chicago. Well, the finances of our city beg, and our state beg, some analogy that people can understand, because the numbers tend to overwhelm us. They tend to basically either frighten you or make your eyes gloss over. There has been some good news, right? We have a budget here in Illinois. This is something that in 49 other states nobody would ever talk about, right? But Illinois tried an experiment for a couple of years without a budget, and we found out just what the 49 other states told us would happen. It was real expensive, and you're not going to like it, and it's not going to be easier at the end. But this year, we did get a budget from the state of Illinois. It was on time before the fiscal year began, and it was somewhat bipartisan. So that was great news. So we can sort of have a sigh of relief. However, as was pointed out by Juan and Tina, there's so much more work that needs to be done. The 2019 budget did not address really what this is all about. What do the taxpayers, what are they going to face? Property taxes. Where are we going to go with property taxes? Did not really address the state's $130 billion in unfunded pension liability. And interestingly for us, it didn't address local government distress. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how many local governments, not just Chicago, not just Chicago Public Schools, and not just Harvey, are struggling in this environment, and the rather silent response that we've gotten. Property taxes are the third rail of politics, right? We know that the public pays more attention to their property tax because it's an ad valorem tax. You can't escape paying them without running the risk of losing your house. And so politically, it's a very dangerous thing to be raising. However, our local governments, and particularly our education governments, our school districts, rely very heavily on property taxes. And so the state's financial instability and its financial recklessness over recent years really is building a wind, hurricane or otherwise, for more property tax increases. There's 7,000 units of local government in Illinois, 6,978, that are highly dependent on property taxes. 2 years ago, when we got our first budget after 2 years, the state cut the local government distribution share by 10%. That was like a 10% cut to local governments. They also began charging them a 2% administrative fee for picking up for collecting their taxes. That was a significant cut to local governments without any relief on what their obligations and expenditures would be. When the state passed the permanent income tax 2 years ago to 4.95%, it was the first time in modern era that the state increased its income tax and didn't share with the local governments. It chose to use all of the proceeds just for state government. Some assistance that the city of Chicago has received is fairly significant, and I must say the city, Mayor Emanuel, has been more successful than I would have imagined in getting help from the alternately functioning state of Illinois. They were able to get money in the form of a property tax TIF. Again, we went to property taxes in spite of everybody saying property taxes are politically dangerous. We're using property taxes to rebuild the Purple Red Line, right? It's a federal loan. It was a great deal for the city of Chicago. We received over a billion dollars in loan money to rebuild our public transit system, but it's backed by a property tax increase. In addition, the state of Illinois approved raising and returning the CPS pension levy in order to make up for the unfunded cost. So those are just two areas where pressure will continue to build on property taxes. This next slide, which nobody likes to see, but which is very important, gives you a sense for everyone who's a resident of the city of Chicago, every man, woman, child, what their debt and unfunded pension liability is. Back in 2012, it was about $31,600 per resident. It's now risen in 2016, the most recent year, because we have to rely on this is both regular debt in the form of general obligation debt for the city. So I'll just go through the bottom. The red one at the bottom is the, I hope it's red, state GO debt, the which is about $2 billion. The next color is, I believe, yellow, is about $8.6 billion. Then the green debt is the state pension liability, and the bluish purple is $15 billion. And the reason why the local is more is because it's proportionate in the size of the city. Certainly the state's overall debt at over $130 billion is bigger than the local. The point, look at all that debt, $35,000 per resident just in our unfunded debt and pension liabilities. It's an enormous amount. And that's an obligation that some people say can't be changed, right? That we have all that unfunded liability in the court cases. That's a big question mark. It's a big question mark for the rating agencies. It's a big question mark for anybody who looks at the city and state finances going forward. At the Civic Federation, we feel very strongly that the state cannot fix its problems by pushing them down on the city and other local governments. In total, the city's unfunded pension liabilities for its major police, fire, muni, and labor funds is about $26 billion. Mayor Emanuel and his team have been successful in getting more money into those pension funds, but it is not sufficient to keep the deterioration. They had to go to Springfield, and this is an important point, especially in a gubernatorial election year, and when all the legislature, the House members, and a third of the Senate are up. You can't make changes to your local pension fund without the state of Illinois' approval by state statute. So the city effectively raised property taxes to fund the police and increased funding for the police and fire, increased the water fees for the municipal, and increased the 911 fees to prop up the labor fund. But come 2020, there's another big bump that comes into these pension funds. These are not funds that can withstand any delay in their contributions. I think we look today at the Chicago Fire Fund. It's somewhere in the magnitude of about 20% funded right now. That means it has 20 cents on the dollar for the existing obligations for the known retirees and existing employees. It's very, very financially precarious. The next slide that I'll show is just to give you an example of where the unfunded liability has gone per capita in the city of Chicago. And so right now, every Chicagoan just on the unfunded pension liability owes about $9,400. That's a lot. That, and when you look at what the tax capacity is, and people that say, oh, the city is just going to have to pay for it, or the state is just going to have to pay for it, where are you going to get that money when it is not a priority to most of the citizens of the city of Chicago to talk about their pensions? It's a priority to talk about what's going on in their classrooms, in their schools, in their public transit, in their roads and bridges, and we have this enormous financial hangover. Most of the growth of that unfunded liability from 2007 to 16 is from historic underfunding of these pension funds, because we never followed what the actuaries told us was the cost of these programs. Instead, we used statutory multipliers that were built into Illinois law that said we'll fund what we want to fund or what we funded previously to make it easier for our budgets. As a result, we have accumulated enormous obligations. With that, I will turn it back over.
Okay, thank you, Lawrence. Okay, let's all take a deep breath, and we'll get some responses from our respondents, and then we'll go to questions. So, Tina, do you want to react to Lawrence's comments?
I was looking also at the city numbers as well, and those are especially scary. I think the police and fire pension goes up by like $297 million by 2020, and the municipal and labor's one goes up by $330. That's 50% by 2022. So these are all terrifying numbers. I was also just in looking up the retired teachers situation. There's retired teachers who made the most. I think there's about 30,000 in the state, And I think about like $1 of every $3 in income tax goes towards their pensions. So those are people that are making a lot of money. And their pensions are about six figures. So they're making $100,000. And not saying that they don't deserve that. Obviously, they don't have a Social Security. But there's maybe room to look at different ways of dealing with these like very high-paid retired teachers. And as any of us know who are in the private industry, we don't know if we're going to have a Social Security. I don't know if I'm going to have Social Security when I'm older. So I think that there needs to be an evaluation of things that might change. And that sounds terrifying for everybody, but it's just kind of a realistic thing that we need to look at. And what Lawrence was saying about the mayor, he really has done a great job in Springfield advocating for ways to save these pension funds. There's several bills in the spring session and last year as well that they would just tag it on to the end. And by the way, we're going to find a way to save this pension fund. There's just all these little elements that he keeps on trying to insert into bills. And the governor is receptive to that because he likes when the city takes care of their pension bills. He doesn't want the state to do any of that. He's all about local governments figuring it out themselves. So I think that it's been working, but as you said, it's not a long-term solution for the city.
Okay, thank you. Juan?
Yeah. I think one thing that I want to make sure I emphasize here is that, there are plans to bring these pension funds into shape. Like, there's a ramp. It'll work. It's just that the only way this is going to work is if the economy continues to grow and investment income meets the expectations that are set by the very smart people who work on all of these forecasts. That's the only way we're going to hit these numbers that are already looking pretty dire right now. I don't know if I saw Chuck Burbridge from the pension fund here. Is he here today? If he was here, what he would say is that, listen, the plan that we've got right now is better than having a plan that doesn't work at all, that we can just talk about, that sounds very fanciful. But this is something that we can actually get done. And I suppose that's true. The thing is, a lot of things have to go right for us to get to a point at which we're not even having this conversation anymore. And that's decades down the road. And believe me, if you think the ramp looks steep now, this is just through 2024, the one that I showed. Just wait till you see what happens by 2059.
Okay, thank you. We have a number of questions here, so let us begin. First question is from Ms. Terry, City Club member. Where are you?
Where is he?
Somewhere out there. Submitted your question. Okay. She's a retired federal employee, the last name of Terry?
Yes.
Oh, there you are, over there. Great. Will this tax problem be a hindrance to Chicago's getting Amazon? Not exactly what you expected. You thought we'd start off with a fastball, but she's throwing a curveball. Okay. Who would like to be the first one to respond to that?
I'll go ahead. So it's not will, the question I would say is, right? We still don't know how Amazon, where will it fare in the Amazon sweepstakes. It is something, this financial distress, recognize that the state of Illinois has the worst rated credit of any of the 50 states by the major rating agencies, that the city of Chicago is non-investment grade, and it's all because of the pensions. Not all, but very large impact of the pensions. So yes, the Amazon officials, just like ADM and McDonald's and Google and the other companies that came, and Caterpillar, who came to the Chicago area, are well aware that the state has a tough financial road ahead of it, are aware that the city of Chicago has big challenges. Interestingly, there's so much else going on internationally in international cities like Chicago that there's enough opportunity that some businesses are willing to still make that investment. There's never been a time that I'm aware of when there were more cranes in the air in the city of Chicago right now in terms of the redevelopment of the Fulton Market in the south and then on the south side. There's a lot going on, which gives you pause to the argument that everybody's leaving Chicago because they're afraid of a tax increase or something else. We're not getting all the investment we could. We don't know what will happen with Amazon. It would be a great plus, but it will be, really interesting to hear why Amazon chooses where they are Amazon will not be a panacea, even with the 50,000 potential jobs, if we don't structurally stabilize our state and local government.
Okay, thank you. Tina or Juan, would you like to comment?
I think that's an important thing to note, that there are other companies that have chosen Chicago and Illinois despite knowing what's on paper or our credit ratings or our pension problems. I do think the mayor and the governor have done a good job at producing a package that looks good to Amazon. I was just at that Discovery Partners Institute location, which they're hoping to build like a new University of Illinois campus out there, and that's one of the sites that they are proposing for Amazon. So it's not there at all, and there's I think about a $500 million investment in it. So they're trying their hardest. They do know that we don't look great on paper, but I do think that the locations that they propose are very interesting, that the company might be interested in doing so. But I do think it's super easy to go with a city that does not have our problems.
And Juan?
Some good points made here, and I think key among them is the fact that Chicago has a resource base that is unrivaled by just about anybody. I mean, there's only a handful of cities on the planet that can really compete with this town as far as tax base and everything else that we have available to us. That's one of the biggest saving graces that Chicago has available to it, is just its potential as an economic engine. So that said, I don't know that, you know, this tax and pension issue alone is something that might dissuade Amazon. I'm sure it's something that they think about, but I just think there's a lot of other factors that they're taking into consideration, too. And just personally, it seems to me like something like D.C. seems to be a little bit more conveniently located for what Bezos is trying to accomplish with the company.
Okay, thank you very much. This is from Bill Bergman, who's with Truth in Accounting. Bill, where are you? Way in the back. Okay. I thought that was an oxymoron. Okay. Truth in Accounting. Here's his question. How can the city's police and fire pension funds project funded ratios rising from 25 to 90% over the next 25 years, yet use blended discount rates because they expect to run out of dollars? Who would like to address that? Let's not everybody jump at once. Lawrence?
Right. Bill, you're really getting down there in the weeds, which I appreciate. And Truth in Accounting has a great record of trying to get as sharp of a pencil on the disparities between funded and unfunded. And so basically what you're pointing to, and I think you're pointing to a larger point, which is that there is no consistency on how the state of Illinois requires reporting for local police and fire pension funds. There are statutory formulas. We do have actuarial reports, right, for all of the major pension funds that are provided, but they are not routinely used by the state when they're making changes to the pension fund, when they're adding benefits, when they're changing the schedule, as they've done in the last couple of years. Nothing was more, well, it was one of the many things that was disconcerting, was to watch the decision this last budget year to see the state decide that we're going to reduce the state's contribution by $450 million based on a buyout for retiring employees of the state, not the police and fire, but that wasn't based on any actuarial study. We don't follow the actuarial math, and then we get surprised by what the outcomes are. So in the case, the reason why the Chicago Police and Fire are able to use blended rates and project a forecast that you may not agree with is, it's because of the same answer always in Illinois, because they can, because the legislature allows it, because we don't think the rules of economics and actuarial science necessarily apply to us, or we don't want to apply them. There's one area related to police and fire that I think all of us need to be aware of, and that is the fact that it's not just the city of Chicago police and fire pension funds that are grossly underfunded, but across the state of Illinois. I mentioned Harvey, where they had to lay off half of their police and fire department just to make 1 year's contribution to avoid getting their entire intercept, which the state comptroller is now required to intercept so it doesn't go to the municipal funds. But there are cities around the state. The city of Cairo in downstate Illinois basically has announced that its police and fire pension fund, or its fire pension fund, will be insolvent next year. That means that they don't have enough assets to even pay their current retirees. At the same time, they have firemen on staff who are paying into a fund that is money is going out faster than it can be invested. And in Alton, they're selling their water treatment plant in the city of Alton just to cover this year's pension contribution. And the thing that is the most troubling to me, and that I would urge you to ask your state representative, ask your state senator, ask any candidate for state office, why doesn't anybody provide any help to these local governments? Why don't the poor people in Harvey, Illinois, which pay the highest property taxes of any place in the state of Illinois, and have just been told they're going to have half the police and fire services, why doesn't anyone from the state of Illinois even offer them the opportunity to say, like they do in Wisconsin, like they do in Indiana and Michigan and Pennsylvania, where the state's going to come in and try to help figure out what's going on? Instead, we just have silence. We don't have a mechanism. And those people that believe bankruptcy is the road for these distressed local governments at least have an obligation to show the local governments in Illinois what that path would be, because we don't have a path. We don't believe at the Civic Federation that bankruptcy should be the default for our local governments. We believe the state has an obligation to help them, to provide evidence and technical support as to what the real financial condition is, and it's been really disappointing, the lack of response by the state.
Okay, thank you. Here's a question directed at our two journalists, so I know that you two want to get in on this one. It's from City Club member David Radowitz. David, where are you? Okay, thank you. Remember, this is a City Club, so everything's fair, no sandbagging, etc. Why don't journalists in Illinois ask candidates and elected officials the hard questions about these issues that are being discussed today?
You're right. You're right. We should be. We should be. Part of the challenge is that this stuff is, okay, let's talk about blended discount rates. I mean, which is a really fascinating issue, don't get me wrong, but I mean, I'll look for that in the next newsletter, by the way, Bill. But, you know, it's these issues are difficult to talk about. They're difficult to talk about in a way that resonates with voters sometimes and doesn't make their eyes glaze over, but they're extremely important to the future of government. So I'm with you there. You know, I just, again, to the point that you were making earlier, we have to remember, and to this idea about discount rates, an analyst put this idea in my head a few months ago, and it's not really left since. Government's underlying credit quality, the quality of our debt, is increasingly tied to the fortunes of the equity markets. Think about what that means. Think about what that means for a pension fund that's 50% funded. Think about what that means for a stock market where we don't know really what's going to happen when you pour gas on a fire on an economy that's doing okay right now, but we don't know what's going to happen in the future. These are the sorts of kind of existential questions that, yes, we should absolutely be asking difficult questions about. So, noted.
Tina? I will say in the governor's race, we've tried really hard to get Jamie Pritzker to tell us his graduated income tax rate, which we will never see probably within the election. But we do hammer them. We ask a million questions. The political reporters that I work with are, they're my competitors, but we kind of like launch onto a candidate a lot of times. If we don't get an answer, the next person will ask. And then the next person will ask. The next person will ask. And sometimes on the fifth try, we'll get an answer. But so we are trying our best. So we do want to know what they're planning to do, both Governor Rauner and J.B. Pritzker. We want to know what their plan is for the pension problem. We want to know what they want to do with income taxes. We want to know whether if J.B. Pritzker wants to do a graduated income tax rate, we want to know what's the level. Will there be a middle class people that are, you know, disproportionately affected by this? Will they be helped out? We need to know the details. So I personally would really like to know this information. So I will do my best to get that.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. This question is from Patricia Bidwell, City Club member. She wasn't sure she'd be here, so she submitted it via our website database system, but she's here. So, Pat, I'm going to read the one over the website database because it's easier to decipher. Okay. Where are you, Pat? Patricia? Okay. She's affiliated with One Third Consulting. Why not exchange a deal to amend the Constitution to allow for a graduated tax, but at the same time amend/update/strengthen the balanced budget provisions to prevent future ongoing fiscal management?
I brought this up to a source of mine in the General Assembly world, and they thought that these exchanges don't really happen, that people kind of have their own ideas. And so they didn't really, this is not really totally possible. There's no, like, magic solution where you can say, hey, I'm going to give you a little bit of this, you're going to give me a little bit of this. That's a lot of the behind the scenes that happens in the budget negotiations, but it's not cut and dry. And also with the Illinois Constitution, it opens a big bag of worms. If we are to make a constitutional amendment on one thing, people are going to complain that we need to do this on other things. Are we going to deal with abortion? Are we going to deal with taxes? So there's a fear of opening the bag of the Illinois Constitution, which stops people from making a lot of these pension changes that people, a lot of people think are necessary.
Okay, Juan?
Remember, this is Illinois. That's all. No, it's absolutely possible. Yes, you can actually amend the Constitution. These are mechanisms that are available through government. It's just a question of how do you get there? And you're exactly right. How do you make a deal like that? And I don't know how that could actually happen.
I think you raise an excellent point, right? We're asked, when you ask one question, do you support a graduated income tax? Do you support keeping your pension promises? That allows you to have one answer. It doesn't allow you to solve generally the state budget problem. Your idea, Ms. Bidwell, of tightening up what has happened on the budgeting, right? The state of Illinois Constitution requires the governor to propose a balanced budget. It also requires the General Assembly to pass a balanced budget. It does not require, we found out, that we enact a balanced budget. And no one has real standing to basically sue when the state, instead of balancing a budget in the traditional spirit, it racks up debt. The state constitution says you need a simple majority to raise taxes and a 3/5 majority to take on debt. But the state takes on debt easier than anything else it does, including borrowing, you know, to pay its unpaid bills, not funding its pensions. A grand bargain is what people talk about. It requires a recognition that there is a problem that you're responsible to solve. It's a responsibility of the governor and the General Assembly. It's a responsibility of the mayor and the city council. Without that pressure that everybody has to do something that they don't necessarily want to, you don't get a balanced budget. You don't get stabilization. Lastly, on the graduated income tax, as Tina said, we have no idea what the rates were going to be. The people who are promoting it can barely tell you what the rates are going to be. And that basically the idea that we are going to wait 2+ years to deal with the state's financial situation that is just above junk bond status is a real question mark. Some of the proponents of the graduated income tax say it could raise as much as $2 billion for the state if we change the rates and if we wait and get that all done. There's a much easier way to make the state's income tax more fair and graduated. We have the most generous exemption for retirement income of any Midwestern state. Regardless of how much money you make, all of your retirement income is tax-free in Illinois. The federal government taxes your retirement income. The state of Illinois should tax your retirement income. And guess what? We could exempt all the socials. If people whose only retirement income is Social Security or less than $50,000 a year, that could all be exempted. And we would still have $2 to $2.5 billion in revenue tomorrow by a simple majority of the Illinois General Assembly and the governor signing it. So my fear on a graduated income tax is not theoretical about what the rates will be, although I have to say anybody who sells you high rates at the top end without a guarantee that there is going to be a rate applied to the majority of Illinois taxpayers are selling you something that is basically described as we'll tax the man behind the tree. Those people, someone else is going to pay for our financial recklessness. It's not going to work. We need to start addressing our problems now. Our gubernatorial candidates and our state representatives owe it to us to tell us what they're going to do rather than they're waiting around to see how the crisis works out.
I will note that no politician wants to tax retirement income.
Right.
No, they don't. Okay. And also that it's very unpopular, like the state income tax. Governor Ogilvie in 1969 is the one who did that, and he lasted one term. So it's doable, but it's very political suicide of a move, I think.
In 69, almost all of the newspapers, all the civic groups and that said this was a great idea, the state needed it, and the voters showed their appreciation by voting him out of office.
Exactly.
Okay. Very good. We've had macro questions, some micros. This is kind of a micro question from Charlie Garner, the Roosevelt University Board of Trustee member. His question is, what makes up the $6,000 per capita difference between the $15,000 per capita total unfunded liability and the $9,000 for four funds?
Thanks for the softball, Charlie. What's the majority of the nine, are you saying?
No, what's the there? There's two slides. One was 15 total, and nine for 4 months.
Oh, yeah, it's the other governments. I'm sorry. So the second slide that I showed you was just the City of Chicago pension funds, that 9,000, right. What's the difference between the nine and the... Oh, I see. Oh, let me make sure I got my colors right. I apologize. It's additional government. It's the share of the Cook County and the Forest Preserve and the Water Reclamation District that are also have unfunded liabilities. I see. I can get into the weeds too.
Okay. Very good. Speaking of Cook County, and that this question is from Fritz Kagi, Democratic candidate for Cook County Assessor. Fritz's question is, California had some of the same deficit, including pension deficit problems, a decade ago. They are on much more solid footing now, running surpluses. How did they do it?
They had budgets every year. Probably that's helpful.
They got more realistic about, you know, their investment returns on the pensions, right? I mean, CalPERS made some tough decisions there. That's part of it, right?
That's the difference between Governor Brown and Governor Walker, right? Governor Brown was basically known as Governor Moonbeam in the 70s in California, was a spending, had a reputation of liberal spending. He was reelected in California after Arnold Schwarzenegger. What did he do? He produced a budget that said we have this available revenue in California, something that we have had a hard time coming to grips with, and showed the state of California what their expenditures would look like with the amount of revenue they had without a tax increase. It frightened higher education. It frightened elementary. They still were making their pension contribution, and he showed them what those cuts would look like. There became citizen referendums, and to your point, there was more discipline on following the budget. They raised some fees and fares. They recovered from an economic downturn faster than we do because of the great natural resources of California. But mostly they dealt with their financial problems. So I just want to point out that Governor Walker ran a very populist notion to the public, telling them that the income tax increase was unnecessary. Certain other people said there were too many members of the General Assembly at the same time, and so there was this built-up resentment backlash. Ogilvie never removed from the position that he did the right thing for the state of Illinois. Not paying your bills, running up your unfunded liabilities, that's not the same thing as being financially responsible, and it's very expensive.
Do you see in this coming gubernatorial election either of the two major candidates, Governor Rauner, J.B. Pritzker, or perhaps even announced yesterday, Mr. Sam McCann, addressing these issues in a very realistic way or simply continuing to offer generalities?
At some point, someone will have to. Somebody's going to have to get very specific here very soon. If not for us, if not for the people sitting in this room, but for the ones who are going to follow us decades down the road.
I think for J.B. Pritzker, as I said, we need the graduated income tax rate number. He talks about legalizing marijuana. We need more information about how much that would bring in. There's been talk about financial transaction taxes, taxing retirement income. Yes, I think that there should be a comprehensive package. I think that's what people need. And as far as the governor, he's campaigning on trying to roll back the income tax, and that I think would be difficult. And also the budget that he signed does use money from the income tax hike. So I think there needs to be, obviously that's a very populist thing to say. Like people don't like that the income tax was hiked, but we need to find a kind of a better explanation of what's filling in the blanks there.
Lawrence?
You know, I'll hearken back to the question that came, how come the reporters aren't doing more? I would say, how come the public isn't doing more? The pressure comes on legislators and on governors to address problems when the public insists. When you have the opportunity to talk to your state rep, when you have an opportunity to talk to Governor Rauner, JB, Sam McCann, the libertarian who's running, tell them the issue that's important to you and ask them. I mean, it's so easy now to reach any of these elected officials, not just through social media, but through picking up the telephone, for email, whatever you wanted to do. That's how they would get to focus on it. I don't know. I have my fears that we're not going to have a very substantive campaign based on what we've seen coming out of the campaign so far. But I know that whoever wakes up in January and finds themselves governor is going to have the exact same problems that the current governor had when he signed the state budget. We're unbalanced. We're unstable. We don't have enough to fund people's priorities in education, public safety, and other areas. We need a comprehensive solution. And you got to work together to make people go. That's what leadership is. It's not giving the people what they think they want. It's explaining to them that they need to do something that is instinctively not where they might want to go, but will be better for them in the long term.
Let's everybody give our panelists a round of applause.